Physics World.
Hello and welcome to the Physics World weekly podcast. I'm Sarah Tesh, features editor for Physics World magazine, and today I'll be joined by my colleagues Hamish Johnston, Mateen Durrani and Tushna Commissaria. So much of today's podcast is dedicated to the November special issue of Physics World, which is on physics at the movies. Although not topics that are often paired together, it turns out there's a lot of crossover between them, from the techniques used in visual effects to the actual scientific content in a movie plot. I'll be chatting to Mateen about the issue and the bumper content, and then Tushna will be here to talk about sci-fi films and her thoughts on the latest one, Ad Astra. First, though, Hamish is here to talk about a phenomenon often used in sci-fi films, wormholes. Hi, Hamish.
Hi, Sarah.
So what exactly is a wormhole, and why are we talking about it?
Well, strictly speaking, a wormhole is not science fiction. It's a hypothetical structure in space-time that is actually allowed by Einstein's general theory of relativity. At least in principle, it's allowed. And it can be thought of as a tunnel that instantaneously links two different places. So think of two points on a sheet of paper. Now, they're separated, but if you were to fold the piece of paper over and put those two points together, they would be right on top of each other. And by doing so, you'd be creating a wormhole. That's sort of the way I understand it. I'm sure there are better ways to understand it. But that's a wormhole in a nutshell.
So despite the fact that they're used in films a lot, they have actually never been detected. But this latest study that you have written about on the website today, that assumes that there is one lurking at the center of the Milky Way?
That's right. Yeah, we know, or we're pretty sure, that there's a supermassive black hole at the center of the Milky Way. And I think this has a mass of about 4 million suns. And it's possible that the sort of immense gravitational field associated with this supermassive black hole has actually created a wormhole that also exists at the center of the Milky Way.
Okay, so what's the plan for detecting this wormhole, and who's actually come up with this idea? Who's studying it?
Well, this is the brainchild of two cosmologists. I mean, I think we'd call them cosmologists because they're dealing with sort of big ideas in gravity, maybe not astrophysicists, although a wormhole is pretty small, so maybe it's small enough to be astrophysics. I'm not clear on the difference between... I'm sure there's a wormhole between cosmology and astrophysics, but let's call them cosmologists. And their names are Decheng Dai and Dejan Stojkovic. And they're sort of imagining a wormhole that surrounds this supermassive black hole at the center of the galaxy. And they think that it could lead to another similar black hole, presumably in another galaxy. And then they take this a bit further, and they think about how the presence of this wormhole would affect a star called S2. Now, S2 is a very well-studied star that orbits really close to the black hole, supermassive black hole, at the center of the Milky Way. So essentially their idea is, imagine a wormhole in the vicinity of the supermassive black hole, and how would that wormhole affect this star called S2? And it sort of gets even weirder than that. So you have to get your imagination running even a bit more. So you've got this wormhole that leads somewhere else. And in this somewhere else, you've got a star that's pretty similar to S2 orbiting that wormhole. It's almost like a sort of a parallel universe, although I'm sure it's not, or mirror existence. And what they say is that there will be a gravitational interaction between S2 and this star at the other end of the wormhole. And this gravitational interaction that occurs through the wormhole could be spotted, at least in principle, by astronomers. So that's basically their idea.
Okay. And can astronomers detect the effect on this twin star of S2?
Well, not at the moment. Apparently, current telescopes are not sensitive enough to see this effect. But Dai and Stojkovic believe that the next generation of telescopes could indeed detect, I don't know, perhaps a slight wobble in S2 that would provide evidence for a wormhole and an interaction with a star at the other end of the wormhole. And you can read more about this in an article written by Keith Cooper. He's our sort of astronomy expert, freelance journalist. And his article is called "Nearby Stars Could Reveal Wormhole at the Center of the Milky Way." And that's on the Physics World website at the moment.
Excellent. And quickly before you go, Hamish, considering the theme of this month's special issue, what is your favourite sci-fi film or science moment in a film?
Well, I'm going to have to say Alien is my favourite sci-fi film. I'm not sure if anybody else has picked that. But I think for a number of reasons. One is that I think it came out when I was sort of in my late teens, and so I can remember going to see it in the cinema and, of course, being, you know, completely shocked by the whole thing. But, you know, I think the concept of, you know, for example, overcoming traveling very long distances by basically putting everybody to sleep rather than, you know, having some weird warp drive, I think is really appealing. It's sort of a realistic solution to interstellar travel. And also, you know, the idea of maybe aliens not being particularly friendly. You know, I know, for example, Stephen Hawking, before he died, sort of questioned various programs for trying to communicate with alien civilizations, because, of course, if they pick up our signal, you never know.
Exactly. Never know what's coming.
Yeah, exactly. So, I thought, you know, and the whole life cycle of the alien, et cetera, and the whole general spookiness of it, I thought was really good. So, yeah, I'll go with Alien.
Excellent choice. Thank you very much, Hamish.
No problem.
And continuing our chat about films, I'm now joined by Mateen Durrani, our editor-in-chief, who it's always best to assume has never seen a movie. Hi, Mateen.
Hello, Sarah.
So the November issue of Physics World is all about physics at the movies. And personally, I've used it as an excellent excuse to catch up on some classic sci-fi films. So I've watched 2001 Space Odyssey, The Martian, Gravity. Last night's was Blade Runner. Have you seen any of these?
Well, we were just saying earlier, I have seen more films than Michael Owen, the footballer, who claims to have only watched 7 films. So I've seen more films than that, but I'm not a big movie buff. Let's put it that way.
If you could pick one of those few films you've seen, which is your favourite kind of science fiction or your favourite science in a film moment?
I was struggling with this yesterday. I mean, I do remember watching The Matrix.
My first ever sci-fi film.
Yeah, I saw that at cinema in Munich in Germany, claim to fame. And so I have seen Gravity, I think. I saw that at cinema in, it was also in Munich, actually, with Sandra Bullock floating around in space. I've seen that one. And I've seen Apollo 13 with Tom Hanks.
Ah, oh, yes.
That is science fiction, science fact.
Yeah.
Dramatised a bit. So I've seen those. Okay, those three. Let's put it down to that.
And your favourite?
Bridget Jones' Diary? No. Gravity. Go with that. That's the most recent of the three.
Yes, that is the three. So I'm considering your distinct lack of enthusiasm for films. How come you let me do this special issue on physics in the movies?
Well, I do know that, you know, movies are big business, and I know a lot of people out there really enjoy films, and I thought this would be a great opportunity to have a special issue of Physics World all about movies and physics and the crossovers, and it brought together quite a few ideas that we've had bubbling under for quite a few years into one issue.
Yeah. What's your highlight from the issue? What's your favourite?
Well, I know what yours was, and that has to be the interview that Jess Wade from Imperial College London did with Daniel Radcliffe. And I know, Sarah, you're a massive Harry Potter fan. I have seen one of the Harry Potter films. I did walk out of it almost, but I stayed to the end. But in the film, in the interview, he talks about his experiences of using visual effects.
Yes.
And that's kind of linked to physics because a lot of the technology is loosely based on advances in simulation and software and motion capture and stuff. So that's probably the most memorable article in the issue is Daniel Radcliffe, Harry Potter star, featuring in Physics World, which has got to be a first.
Yeah, it's probably a once-in-a-lifetime moment, that. So, yeah, like you were saying, he talks about working with VFX from the point of view of being in front of the camera. But we also have the feature From Weightlessness to Curly Hair, which talks about the science involved after they've done the filming and before he goes to cinema and stuff like that, and all of like the major amounts of physics that go into like the simulations and everything. And something that I was actually quite surprised by was the fact that the VFX industry is so closely linked to scientific research.
Yeah, that's right, Sarah, because, of course, the feature by Michael Brooks, which you mentioned, From Weightlessness to Curly Hair, is all about VFX, and it starts off by talking about Tim Weber, who's a physics graduate from Oxford who works in the VFX industry at a firm in London called Framestore, and he's done loads of... Well, that company's done loads of VFX stuff.
Yeah, major movies.
Interstellar, I think.
Yeah, Interstellar was in there. Oh, no, was Interstellar Double Negative?
I think Interstellar was Double Negative, but he's worked on Harry Potter and the Goblet of Fire.
The Dark Knight. Dark Materials series, yeah. That's on the BBC at the moment. He's Framestore works on that.
Yeah. So that was great, you know, an article all about physicists and other people working with him on VFX technologies, which have come, you know, huge strides in recent years. In fact, what I love in the film, in the feature, he talks about the upcoming remake of Lady and the Tramp, where the sort of simulations of the dogs are so amazing that the team involved can't actually tell apart what are the real dogs from the pretend dogs. And we really wanted to have a picture of a kind of comparing these two, but it's all sort of totally under embargo because the film's due to come out later this month. So unfortunately, no pictures of that. But I just thought that was incredible that they themselves can't even tell what is a real dog from an animated dog.
Yeah, it's incredibly impressive how close they can get to reality nowadays. Like they were also talking about the fact that there's like in the title we talk about the curly hair and about how that so that's to do with the fact that your hair behaves like springs and stuff like that, and they had to use physics models and everything for doing animations like Brave, where the heroine has really big curly ginger hair. And yeah, it's just there's elements of physics going into so many different things that you don't really think about.
And also what really intrigued me was when working with you on the feature was that VFX can create great sort of simulations of the human face, almost so realistic that you can't tell. However, putting human emotions onto the face is really, really difficult. And making a face move that's angry, or it moves in a way that's jealous, or it moves in a way that's surprised, that's the really hard thing that is, you know, very, very difficult, and something I never quite thought about how challenging that would be for a physicist.
Another very close connection with scientific research there was the whole black hole in Interstellar and the way that they did that, and they actually had Nobel Prize winner Kip Thorne involved in the modelling of that, and there were scientific papers and everything, which I completely did not realise, having not seen the film.
Yeah, well, that's another film I haven't seen, but you know, it's on my list of things to do and watch.
When you get around to watching that, you have to think about the fact that, you know, there's actually so much proper physics behind that.
Yeah,
which is
yeah,
very
incredible.
So as well as the off-screen processes, the issue also talks about the science that's happening on screen, and that's part of the plot. And one of the themes that gets picked up in a few of the articles, actually, is the fact that there's obviously a kind of battle sometimes between getting the science right and getting a good movie. And in the article Turning Science to Movie Magic, Emily Lorditch talks to physicists who have actually advised filmmakers about depicting science and scientists. And we also have an interview with Caltech physicist Spyros Michalakis. I'm really sorry if I'm pronouncing that wrong. And he describes his experiences as a movie consultant on films like Spider-Man Homecoming, Ant-Man and Ant-Man and the Wasp, and the Bill and Ted's recent one that's coming up. And there are some really cool stories about physicists being involved in movies from the science advising point of view.
Yeah, the one I loved in the feature that you just mentioned, Sarah, was Emily Lorditch, who wrote it, talks to Sean Carroll from Caltech, who says that on one of the films that he worked on, he wasn't allowed to use the word wormhole because apparently it was too 90s. So the you know, some of this, as a movie consultant, you're battling over individual words and things that are taken out of scripts on completely irrational and flimsy basis.
So that was for the film Thor, one of the Marvel movies, and instead of calling it wormholes, they called them Einstein-Rosen bridges, which is an alternative name for a wormhole.
But got around the problem of wormhole being too 90s.
Yeah.
Right. Love it.
I also quite like the story that Spiros talks about and how Keanu Reeves, when he was on the set of Bill and Ted, and the new Bill and Ted film that's coming out.
Which I haven't seen either.
No, yeah, because it's out in
2020. Oh, brilliant. So I've got a good excuse.
Excellent excuse there. And he talks about how he, Keanu Reeves came up and was just like, so what's new in physics? And Spiros just starts talking about how it's all this simulation and all this complex quantum physics. And Keanu Reeves is just kind of like, nah, you're talking rubbish. But then comes back a bit later and is just kind of like, okay, so what do you mean by that? And like by the end of filming, like everyone was finding out about all of this cool science that's happening.
I mean, that must be pretty cool, be on set with a load of actors. And he used that opportunity to actually talk about a bit of physics that didn't really have much to do with the film, but
yeah.
He just got the actors and all the crew and whoever excited about science.
Yeah.
With some pretty influential people. So it's a, you know, in terms of bang for buck for outreach purposes, it's got probably pretty good.
Yeah. But there are sometimes the instances where science isn't quite right in the films, but like they kind of ignore it because it makes the film better. And so, I mean, let's call them science blunders. Are you the kind of person who gets annoyed with those kind of things when you see wrong science on a film?
To be honest...
On the few films that you have seen.
To be honest, no, because I'm more struggling to keep up with the plot. And I don't let it distract... You know, I'm not one of these people who... I don't mind spoilers. I don't care. I just want to watch the film. I'd rather know what's going on. I have a real problem with following plot lines. So anyone who can help me with the plot, is that's a really good thing. So the bloopers, I don't care. But yeah, you mentioned the feature by...
So we have a feature by Rhett Allen. It's called The Fictional Science of Science Fiction, where he picks out three quite common mistakes that movies make. And so that will be online next week. He talks about how, in some instances, it's a case of it just makes filming easier. Like Gravity, for example. Not the film, the actual physical force. About how that's very hard to film. So an easy way of getting around that is by saying that, you know, as soon as there is air pressure in an airlock on a spaceship, you suddenly have gravity. And obviously that's not true unless the ship has a special gravity-inducing mechanism. But it makes it a lot easier for filming because you don't have the actors floating around, which is quite handy.
And I think the interesting thing, even if you get annoyed by bloopers, I think the point made in the feature is the fact that films are a great learning opportunity for people who are into physics to sort of tell other people who aren't particularly into science. It's a good excuse to talk about some basic physics. And there's always a new film coming, you know, around the corner. So you can use those bloopers as a kind of way of explaining in a kind of cool way, an interesting way about proper science and using the film and then maybe the errors in it to illustrate accurate science in a kind of easy way.
Yeah, it's actually one of the things that Kip Thorne talks about in the Science Advisor feature is the fact that he reached a much larger audience than he ever would by working on Interstellar.
Yeah, that's right.
Which for a Nobel Prize winning physicist is a big thing to say because he reaches a bigger audience because he's a bigger name. But the fact that you work through film as well, it's a really good tool for science communication.
Yeah, so people will be a bit sniffy about movie physics and all the errors and they can get on their high horse about how ridiculous it all is, but it's a great opportunity to, or an excuse to talk about real science.
And there is so much physics involved, like we were saying, with the visual effects.
Yeah,
and everything
exactly.
As well. So what other highlights are in my spectacular issue of physics of film?
Well, we've got another interview with Benedict Cumberbatch, who starred in, quickly remind me, Sarah,
The Imitation Game, the TV, Stephen Hawking TV film documentary style thing called Hawking.
And so that interview is all about what it's like as a actor to play a scientist, from the point of view of how to portray someone who is working in science. And it's actually an interesting thing, Sarah, when we were putting together the issue of physics and movies, that physics is pretty dominated by men, but so are movies. Put the two together, and it's really hard to find a decent film which involves a woman and who is also a scientist.
Yeah,
we did quite struggle with
really
that.
Hard trying to find some kind of physicist who was a woman who was involved in film, and on that Venn diagram, that is a very tiny percentage of people.
I mean, there's one film from years ago from the 90s, I think it was Contact, wasn't it? Which featured Jill Tarter, who was a sort of a scientist searching for extraterrestrial life. And that was a film in the 90s featuring an actor. I can't remember who it was, but playing her. And that was one example I could come up with. So, going back to this current issue of physics, where we've got Benedict Cumberbatch talking about what it's like to be an actor playing a scientist. And then we've also got an interview with
Douglas Trumbull.
Douglas Trumbull, who, to be honest, I'd not heard of before. But
then when you read his resume, it's pretty impressive. So he did he did a lot of the VFX stuff on films like 2001 Space Odyssey, Blade Runner, which is why I watched those two films recently, and Encounters of the Third Kind. And yeah, he's got this very impressive list of films, and he's also directed some as well.
Yeah, and he's really making the point that movie makers can learn a lot from scientists, and vice versa. Scientists can learn from the techniques of movie makers. So that's really worth reading as well.
Yes, there's a nice array of articles, if I do say so myself.
Yeah, well done, Sarah.
Thanks. Oh, thanks, Mateen. And if you want to check out any of these articles, they will be appearing on our website over the course of the month. And for members of the Institute of Physics, you can also find the full magazine via the Physics World app. Thanks, Mateen.
Thank you.
Bye. I am now joined by Tushna Commissaria, our reviews and careers editor, and our resident film buff. Hi, Tushna.
Hi, Sarah.
I've asked Mateen and Hamish this already. Mm-hmm. So let's start with, what is your favourite science film or science moment in a film?
That's an impossibly hard question. Because there are lots of like really good moments. Off the top of my head, I would say possibly my favourite sort of hardcore science film, a science moment in a film, would probably be the first time you see the black hole in Interstellar. And just knowing everything I know about how that entire black hole had been designed, and the
involvement of Kip Thorne.
Exactly.
Yeah, Mateen and I were talking about this earlier.
Exactly.
Yeah,
that's
really impressive.
And I think it was made all the more impressive by the fact that the Event Horizon Telescope took a photo of the shadow of a black hole, and so we now have confirmed proof that that is what it would look like.
Yes,
so
it's very cool.
It really can't get any better, can it?
No, it's so impressive that they were so like close to the real answer.
Yes, indeed. And I think, but going back a lot more, one of my favourite films that involve science, it had its issues for sure, but it's such a great film, and that's Contact. And interestingly enough, both Contact and Interstellar were made by Linda Obst, who was a very good friend of Carl Sagan's, and they, you know, worked closely together, and Contact was written by Carl Sagan. And that had, you know, the moment where Jodie Foster travels through a wormhole to Vega, this distant star. It was such a cool moment, and they did that. I mean, you know, if you look back at the graphics now, they look awful. She's kind of falling through what looks like a TV screen almost, with just loops and lights around her and things like that. But they did that really nice little thing where, you know, she feels like she's traveling for ages, and in reality on Earth it was like a 30-second drop, and so kind of no one believes her. But yeah, Contact's an amazing film. If you haven't watched it.
In contrast, mm-hmm. what's your opinion, the worst example of science on screen?
Oh, gosh. Now, that's another one that's impossibly hard to pick because there are so many. Yeah, the list is truly depressingly long.
Yeah.
But then there's like examples of, you know, we were chatting about this earlier, weren't we? That there are examples of really bad science and what are really fun films.
Yes.
You know, if you look at Spaceballs and Galaxy Quest,
and then there's
Starship
also
Troopers.
All those examples where to make the movie good, not necessarily like the fun, those kind of fun films, but just to make the movie a great film, they kind of, you know, brush over some of the
physics. Exactly. My favorite example of that is the flux capacitor. It's just great. How do you travel in time? It's the flux capacitor. Or you know, the classic Ghostbusters, don't cross the beams. Gotta love it, but what is happening there?
Weren't you saying about Honey, I Shrunk the Kids?
Yes, that was so years ago when I was still at university doing my BSc, we had this like competition to tackle bad movie science, and my friend and I took part in it, and we did like a physics project on all the reasons why Honey, I Shrunk the Kids just wouldn't work, and the sort of size of laser you would need to like actually compactify a human being, and what that would actually do to the human being, and then, you know, when they're really small, the like the relative size of everything else that they see, which would probably also like, you know, be similar for things like the borrowers. So yeah, you can really, I mean, you know, but that was obviously taking it to an extreme. I love Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. It's great.
So for the issue, the November issue of Physics World, you reviewed one of the latest sci-fi films to hit the cinema. So that was was Ad Astra, which stars Brad Pitt. For you, which category does that fall into, would you say?
Unfortunately, and I'm very sad to say this, firmly in the latter, in the
bad, but not so
science.
Good.
Yes, exactly. I mean, if you really want to hear what I feel about it, I would say read the review, which is, you know, 950 words of me telling you why I think it's bad.
Or a half an hour conversation.
Yes. I must admit that I have perfected a
I do now know exactly
narrative.
What's going to happen, what happens in the film.
It was one of those films that I had such high hopes for because I thought it would firmly follow in the lines of films like Interstellar and Gravity and
Arrival, such a great run of those kind of films.
Exactly. So I thought, right, excellent. It's been enough years now since Interstellar. You know, it's very promisingly called Ad Astra. And I remember watching the trailer a couple of months ago and thinking, this is going to be great. It looks cool. It did seem a bit, even in the trailer, but I was happy, you know, I was happy to go with that slightly more sort of ponderous, you know, I quite enjoy those kind of films. And so I went to watch it along with a bunch of other people who more popularly known as the Cosmic Shed Gang.
Ah, yes.
So this is Andrew, who does our
monthly
stories podcast.
And he also did our Benedict Cumberbatch interview in the issue.
He did indeed. So, you know, they regularly watch and discuss science films, theatre, all of the science and the arts, really. And so we went to watch it all together. And, I mean, once the film was over, every single one of us kind of, like, turned to each other and went, what the heck was that? You know, we all had slightly different takes on it, but no one really enjoyed it, unfortunately. In fact, two of our group of six fell asleep. Now, it should be mentioned that they had, they were rather jet lagged and quite tired, but both of them said that they've never fallen asleep in a cinema before.
Oh, that's not a good sign.
Yeah, exactly. And they kind of fell asleep, woke up significant time later and were like, oh no, it's still on.
No.
I think the most critical way in which I could describe it is that it's like 2 hours and 20 minutes of a beautifully filmed perfume commercial. You know what I mean? Like perfume commercials where there's really high design quality and people are saying
it looks
really
beautiful.
Yeah, it looks stunning and everyone looks really serious and there's like these brilliant moments and like, you know, 3 minutes later you're like, what are they selling? Oh wait, it's a perfume. Right. It was exactly like that. You know, it was just all so vague and thing after thing after thing just kept happening and you were like, oh my gosh, why?
Without giving too much away, mm-hmm. can you give us an example of one of the bad? One of them. The bad.
Why? Okay. I would say that right in the beginning, in the first sort of 20 minutes or so, something happens that they describe as the surge. And without really explaining
why.
Yes, the surge. It's somehow happening simultaneously across the world and seems to involve some kind of electrical surge. But then it's just like, you know, from like an electrical surge just suddenly goes to planes are falling out of the sky and thousands dead across the globe already, and I'm a bit like, wait, why? And then you know, Brad Pitt, who's the astronaut and the lead in the film, he's kind of pulled into this secret debrief with Space Corp, which is the futuristic, scary version of NASA, I'm guessing. And you know, they're giving him a debrief of what happened or what they think happened, and they're just dropping all these words in, like, you know, suddenly it goes from surge to antimatter and cosmic rays, and somehow something's creating cosmic rays near Neptune using antimatter, which has caused the surge on it. And I was like, oh no, that was my first real of this isn't good.
It kind of sounds like they've gone and got a dictionary full of physicsy words and gone, oh, that's a cool word.
Exactly.
Antimatter, cosmic rays.
Exactly. Yay. And then, because some of this action is happening near Neptune, for some reason he has to travel to Mars to use a laser to communicate with someone
on Neptune.
And that why exactly? I mean, you could say, oh, might be a bit quicker, communications at the speed of light, but you just spent 19 days on a ship trying to get to Mars, and that was via the moon.
Naturally,
you know.
Yeah.
And I think, I mean, do you not want me to give away the main part of the plot then? Should we not?
I would avoid that.
I think at the end of it, there's a The message in here, similar to the message in Interstellar. You know, in Interstellar, I mean, a lot of people thought that it didn't work at the end. I didn't mind it so much. It was, you know, about sort of love across the universe and, you know, kind of his love for his daughter and that. And there's a similar theme over here. But I think it's executed even worse. If you didn't like that in Interstellar, you're definitely not going to enjoy that here. And it seems to be that what the director really wants you to come away with is to really point out that as human beings we've only got each other to fall back on. That's the general message.
Mm.
But for such a simple and basic human message, he sends Brad Pitt literally across the solar system to figure this out. And I feel like there's easier ways to do that.
Yeah.
And I also get the feeling, I mean, there was an interview, I've actually linked to it in the online version of our story, so you can go check it out, where the director, James Gray, actually sort of says that he kind of doesn't like the idea of aliens, whether they're intelligent or not. And I think that kind of finding that out later on makes sense to me through, I was like, okay, that explains it. And I mean, not to say that this is in any way a good or a bad thing, but considering that this film was set in the future at some point, and you know, they are all on international missions and things like that, there were quite a few moments that were surprisingly religious, you know, at different points when they're on the ship, you know, they sort of say a little prayer to Saint Anthony before setting off from the moon to Mars and things like that. So I think there's, you know, there's some of that sort of bit
underlying
more
messages,
religious allegory with, like, you know, we're special and it's just us kind of thing going.
Okay.
Yeah.
So all in all, not your favourite film?
No. I mean, I'll say this, that it looks beautiful. The special effects are amazing. All the different planets you visit, they look stunning. It was filmed in 35mm, which, and you know, it somehow looks very futuristic, but also has that sort of grainy dystopian vibe to it, which is quite cool. So it looks beautiful.
Okay.
But, yeah.
And the article is Crash and Burn.
Mm-hmm.
And that is now available on our website,
yes,
right?
That's
as
right.
Well as in the magazine.
Yeah.
Okay, so we're going to finish our podcast on film and physics with a little bit of a game. And so we're joined again by Tushna and Mateen for this. I kind of need to give credit to my husband for this, Chris Batten, because he came up with the answers and the game in general. Okay, hi guys, are you ready?
Yeah,
I guess.
So this game works like this. I'm going to give you a clue, and it's going to be about a physicist and a film. And you need to work out what it is, and their name, the two things are linked through wordplay. Nothing else, nothing to do with what's in the film or what they did or anything like that. Purely wordplay, okay? I'm going to give you an example.
Yeah, give us an example.
Okay, so we've got Danish physicist who made foundational contributions to the atomic structure is found floating in the Mediterranean Sea with gunshot wounds and no knowledge of who he is. In an attempt to unravel his past, he gets into a lot of action fights with CIA assassins.
So the answer is?
So the answer is Niels Bohr Identity. Get it?
Right, okay. Yes. Right.
Do you want another example?
Are these all from Chris? Right.
I mean, I gave him some help with the physicists, but
okay.
Yeah. Okay, so in this 1988 animated film filled with dinosaurs, Canadian optical physicist, celebrated for her work in pulsed lasers, flees disaster and goes in search of the Great Valley.
And the answer is?
Donna Strickland Before Time.
Okay.
Yeah.
You get that,
okay. Tushna?
Yes.
But I'm not sure if
I'm feeling really nervous about
anything.
This. The amount of films that I know, I'm feeling really
I have tried to pick ones which are a bit more on your level, Mateen. Don't worry.
Does it involve Bridget Jones?
No, I'm sorry.
Damn.
I couldn't think of one for Bridget Jones. Okay. Right. You ready?
Go.
Not really.
So British theoretical physicist and cosmologist who made groundbreaking contributions in general relativity, quantum mechanics and black holes, is brought to Bangkok to tutor the many children of the King of Siam in this period musical film.
Stephen Hawking and I.
Congratulations! Thought I'd start with a nice and easy one.
I'm good at this.
Okay. British mathematician, known for publishing the first computer algorithm, is an eccentric private detective who specialises in retrieving missing animals and wears colourful Hawaiian shirts.
Oh,
What, British what?
Wait, but how do...
What was the first bit?
Kind of Ace Ventura, but I'm wondering how to bring in the Alan Turing bit.
It was Alan Turing.
No,
it's not Alan
Turing,
is it?
You said British mathematician.
Well, yes.
Female.
Female.
Mm.
Ada Lovelace?
Yes.
Ooh.
How do you put them together?
What was the second bit?
Ada Lovelace, pet detective?
Ada Lovelace Ventura, pet detective.
Oh, I see.
So close.
Ooh,
basically
not bad.
Okay, I'll give you one more, and then we'll give some for the listeners. American theoretical physicist, whose name is given to diagrams behaving, describing subatomic particles, is a wealthy child who has to thwart a money-hungry subordinate of his father's with the help of his new friend.
Wait, no, I didn't get that at all. What did you say?
So, the physicist is a wealthy child who has to thwart a money-hungry subordinate of his father's with the help of his new friends. It features a people-throwing machine. Which is the main thing I remember from it.
People throwing
machine.
Yeah, like a human catapult.
Oh, is this an animated film?
No.
Oh,
it's
not.
A kids film.
Kids film from what decade?
I'd say the '90s.
Well, it's fine.
No.
Oh,
it's the same.
Ooh.
Is it?
Actor.
Is it Macaulay Culkin? Mm. Another Macaulay. Oh, is it Richie Rich? So it's Richie Rich and. something. There's a longer name of the title.
No,
is it just...
The film is just called Richard Rich.
Richard Rich, is that it?
Richard Rich Feynman.
Richie Richard Feynman, yeah.
Richie.
I know, brilliant, isn't it? It's fine, just blame Chris, not me.
I'm not sure
Chris,
how
not
you
me.
Remember that it was Richie Rich. I have no idea why that came into my brain, but there you are.
Okay, so I have a few more, which I was thinking that you, the audience, could have a go at. And you can send your answers to us via our Twitter, at PhysicsWorld, or if you want, an email at pwld@iopublishing.org. Or if you have any other ideas for ones which are better than these.
So you got three.
So I've got three, okay. So, gifted with obedience by a fairy, astrophysicist famous for the discovery of pulsars has to hide her curse from her new stepfamily in this adaptation of Cinderella. Tushner is nodding. She gets this one.
I know the discoverer bit. I have no idea.
Okay, we'll go for another one. In this romantic comedy drama musical, engineer and inventor best known for his contributions to AC electricity dances with an aspiring actress in a yellow dress on a vista overlooking LA.
Sorry.
No idea.
Neither?
Well, no. The first bit I know, the scientist. Okay. I think.
She even said yellow dress, come on.
No idea.
Okay, well, hopefully someone else will get it. Italian astronomer from the 16th century wants to escape the London drug business in this British crime film. Right, okay, so that is it. Thank you very much for playing the game, guys.
It's been a pleasure, I think.
You think?
We tried.
After the King
we
and
tried.
I love that. I got my story with that one. That was easy, though.
Well done. I'm afraid that's all for this week's podcast. Thanks to Tushna, Mateen and Hamish for joining me today, and a special thanks to our producer, Callum Jelf. And remember, if you like what you hear, then you can subscribe to the podcast via Apple Podcasts or your chosen podcast app. We're also available on Spotify, so you can follow us there. Thank you for listening, and please do join us again next week.
Physics World.